Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Later in the hour, I'll talk to a local writer celebrating her 90th birthday on this Valentine's Day. We'll also hear from authors in a writing group that met at the Jesus Center in Chico. This group was the idea of my first guest, Emily Gallo. Emily Gallo was born in New York City and lived in San Francisco and Los Angeles before moving to Chico when she married economics professor David Gallo. She has a BA in English from Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts, and taught elementary school students in low-income, ethnically diverse neighborhoods before retiring and starting a writing career. With three other women, Emily Gallo founded a writing group at the Jesus Center in Chico. She got the idea from a screenplay she wrote called The Road Not Taken, about a protagonist who founded a writing group for the homeless in New York's Central Park. The Chico group published two literary magazines called The Derelict Voice. We'll be hearing from these authors later in the show. Emily Gallo's first novel, Venice Beach, started out as a TV show. She wrote a pilot and a few episodes before deciding to turn it into a novel. She has now completed a sequel to Venice Beach, The Columbarium. Tomorrow, she will be launching her new book at a fundraiser for the Museum of Northern California Art, whose home will be the Veterans Memorial Hall in Chico. Emily Gallo, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, you decided to turn your book that was a screenplay into a novel. Why did you change from a screenplay to a novel?
Well, first of all, the whole Hollywood has gone crazy. It's it's very difficult now to get screenplays on. I had actually had written The Columbarium as a screenplay, and I had a producer. I had everything on track. We had investors from Europe, and it was all going very well, and then in typical Hollywood fashion, it fell apart. So I said, you know, I think I'd rather write a novel where I have a little more control. And so that's what I've done. I've switched to being a novelist at this point.
Well, then the title of your book, I think, is a mystery in itself. The Columbarium? What is that?
I have met one person who knows what a columbarium is, and they are all over the place. I've been to them in other cities. They're not unique. But I'd like to tell the little story about how I found the columbarium in San Francisco.
Well, yeah, I do want to know how you became interested in the San Francisco Columbarium, but I think maybe it might be that it relates to a subject that we don't want to think about.
Well, the thing about the Columbarium in San Francisco is that it's a rather pleasant place to be. It's a beautiful building, and, well, I guess we need to tell people what a columbarium is.
Well, yes, do that.
Let's start there. A columbarium is a building that has niches. And it's where people put their ashes in urns or some other...
After being cremated.
So instead of a mausoleum or a cemetery, people can use a columbarium for the ashes, or instead of strewing the ashes in the ocean or wherever. And that's what a columbarium is, and they are everywhere. This particular columbarium that I wrote about is in San Francisco.
And how did you become interested in writing a novel about something that sounds depressing?
Well, that's what was such an interesting story. I have a friend who lives in San Francisco, and I was living in Davis at the time. He was visiting me. This is probably 7 years ago or so. And he said, you know, where can I get a Chinese food takeout carton, one of those cardboard cartons? I said, I don't know. I guess at a Chinese restaurant, but why would you need that? He said, well, I have a friend who's dying, and she wants to put her ashes in it, to put in the columbarium. And I said, huh? And that was how one of the characters in the book, I will say,
so
has her ashes.
This.
I used that. That was the spark. And I didn't know what a columbarium was either. And the story he told was exactly the story that is in the book with Tony trying to find one of those takeout cartons that he could use to put his friend's ashes in.
Yeah, so even though this is a novel, I knew that a lot of it was true. I mean, this columbarium really exists in San Francisco,
yes,
so I know that
does.
Was true. And then you were just saying that the incident with the guy looking for a Chinese carryout carton for his friend's ashes was true.
And then I went to visit the columbarium in San Francisco.
Where in San Francisco is this?
It's at 1 Lorraine Court, which is up in the Richmond area, north of the park, Golden Gate Park.
Because Colma is famous for its cemetery, and so you might expect it to be there.
Well, yeah, and there's actually another columbarium in Oakland. There's a couple in New York, and I've been to one of them in New York, which is from Revolutionary times, and actually Leonard Bernstein was buried in the one in New York. And the one in San Francisco has some famous people, Mr. Haight, Mr. Ashbery, both buried there or in niches there.
My guest is Emily Gallo, and she is telling us about her latest novel, which is a sequel to her earlier book, Venice Beach. This one is the Columbarium, which is a real architectural feature, a real building, and she has visited the one in San Francisco.
And so I went to visit it, and there is really a caretaker there whose name is Emmett Watson, and I spoke with him, and he is actually nothing to do with
You have a character in your book that's a caretaker
exactly.
for the Columbarium in your book. And this also is based on a real person. You certainly didn't use his name.
Exactly.
His real name was
Emmett Watson. Mm-hmm. And it's, as I said, it has nothing to do with Jed, but it was just the spark I needed, you know, visiting this incredible building. It's gorgeous. Looking at the niches, talking to Emmett, and then I just decided to take pictures of some of the niches. I didn't want to know the people that were buried in them. It just started the whole creative process of, oh, this would be a great, well, at the time, screenplay. And I took pictures and just made up characters that would have to do with the niches that I took pictures of. And that's how it all started.
So that you could tell the story of these characters and their relationship to the Columbarium.
Right.
So when you were selecting characters, you had some characters already in mind. Oh, well, these characters could be doing these things, having these experiences. But you start, though. So the main character in this book has a very interesting background. And you start your book in the prologue, telling us, you don't say who is speaking. This is told in the first person, but we don't know who this person I is. What is that prologue?
The prologue, why don't I read a little of it to just give an idea. White knight, white knight, everyone to the pavilion right away. Your lives are in danger. Was this the real thing or another one of his cruel jokes, the ones he called rehearsals? We'd been on our best behavior for the congressman and his entourage last night. We sang and danced and told him how much we loved being here and how wonderful father was. I asked my mother why she believed all this crap. She looked at me with vacant, fearful eyes, but didn't answer. She just held my baby sister tight to her chest. When his voice came over the loudspeaker, we knew we had to go. She took my hand, and we walked to the pavilion.
Now, Emily, when I read that, at first I didn't know White Knight, everyone at the pavilion, but then you mentioned his cruel jokes, his rehearsals, but then you said we'd been on our best behavior for the congressman and his entourage last night. Then I knew where this was taking place. And these were the actual words of Jim Jones, as I remember them. You actually used his dialogue.
Exactly.
And
They took us and put us in chains. They robbed us of our land. We tried to find a new beginning, but it's too late. Don't lay down with tears and agony. We must die with some dignity. Mother, 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 please. Mother, please, 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 don't do this. Lay down your life with your child, but don't do this.
Yeah, I remember hearing those words of James Jones when he was asking people to commit suicide, to drink the Kool-Aid. And since then, we've had that expression. I don't know if people now remember where that came from.
As I ask around, it's kind of like the Columbarium.
People don't
know. People under the age of 40 or 50, I guess I should say, because this was all in the late 70s.
Yeah. This was taking place, you might remind people then,
Guyana.
Right. So here is Jim Jones. He had this place that the people from the Bay Area relocated there, and they committed suicide. Now we have in this prologue, I had to find my mother and my sister. So far, this has been based on fact. We know these are the words of Jim Jones. But what about this I person?
This I person is the protagonist of the Columbarium, Jed.
So this is the fictional person.
The fictional person. It was him as a child, and he escaped from Jonestown.
So your book then starts when Jed, the protagonist, Jed Gibbons, is on a bus, and he had been living in Los Angeles. And pick up there.
He had spent the last few years living on the boardwalk in Venice Beach, and he needed sleep more than he needed picturesque scenery. He crumpled his jacket into a ball and put it against the window of the bus. He leaned his head into it and shut his eyes. It did its job, a warm, soft barrier between him and the cold glass. He closed his eyes and started practicing his breathing techniques. Sleep never came easily. He had spent too many nighttime hours having to be vigilant and had learned to function on very little sleep. But it also meant that sleep evaded him on those few occasions when he felt safe and secure in his bedtime circumstances. He had learned these breathing techniques when one of the boardwalk denizens had steered him to the Venice Buddhist temple. They taught techniques called pranayama as a vehicle for meditation, but Jed wasn't interested in that. He didn't care much for the spiritual benefits of the Buddhist religion, or any religion for that matter. He used the exercises purely to release tension. He didn't care much for the yoga part either. He just liked to walk.
Now, the character that this is based on, you mentioned that this was a real person, Emmett Watson, who was a caretaker, but none of this sounds like it would pertain to Emmett Watson. However, I did wonder, because your main character is homeless, virtually, if that was realistic, if you ran into homeless people who went to a Buddhist the Buddhist temple in Venice.
Actually, no. I knew it was just all in my head.
Okay.
He suffers from what happened to him as a Jonestown survivor, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. he's been homeless all these years. And that, I guess, to me, even though I'm not necessarily a practicer of, is what Buddhism would do. Mm-hmm. in my mind, would help in terms of calming.
Mm-hmm. Because, for example, sleeping, you said that the breathing techniques to be learned at the Buddhist temple. Actually, pranayama is from yogic tradition, not uh-huh. necessarily Buddhist.
But, okay.
But you say that your character liked to walk. And then let's skip down to the description of this person, Jed, because so far we don't know what he looks like. But we do know if he was at Jonestown, a lot of the residents of Jonestown were African-American.
Correct.
So read your description.
Jed was a tall, thin, muscular African-American. He was pushing 50, but easily looked 15 years younger. His hair, cut short, was barely graying at the temples, and his skin was smooth. He was one of those people who turned heads, but not because of his physical attractiveness, although he was quite handsome. It was his air of mystery and aloofness that drew them in. He had the stamina of a long-distance runner with a gait and demeanor that were slow and deliberate. He had anger issues, but he was never physically aggressive unless someone threw the first punch. When he did lose his temper, he would walk for miles. That helped some to calm him. He didn't like to lose control, but it could happen a little too easily. He hadn't been back to the Bay Area for a number of years. He thought it would be a good place to hide and get the proverbial fresh start. He had already had several fresh starts, but this one was different. This one was imperative. This time, he was running from the law. And if you remember the end of Venice Beach.
Yeah. This is Emily Gallo reading from her new novel, which is a sequel to Venice Beach, The Columbarium. And here you say, this time he was running from the law. Well, if people have not read Venice Beach, they think, what? The police are after this guy? He seems such a nice guy. Why would the police be after Jed Gibbons?
Shall I tell?
No.
I don't want to give it all away.
I'm just saying, as a reader, that's what we were wondering.
Right.
But he's such a nice guy. So we learned that he gets angry, but he is able to function and not let that control him. So we learned the protagonist, we get to know him. But now I would like you to tell us about the Columbarium, because this is the very title of your book. And this is about on page 30 in your book, Emily.
Okay.
That you start.
31.
This,
okay,
yeah,
gotcha.
This building was 3 stories high.
It was 3 stories high and built as a rotunda. The walls of all the floors were filled both horizontally and vertically with glass door indentations of different sizes. They stood in the center of the main room and were surrounded by thousands of these niches. Jed noticed there were small rooms off the circle, and the walls of these rooms were also covered from floor to ceiling with niches.
People might, if they hear the rotunda, that is a rotunda, I think that helps them, because so much of San Francisco is Victorian architecture and homes. and this rotunda, like, we have a rotunda in our capital city. So this building must look maybe like some of the architecture in Washington, D.C. And would people be right about that?
Yes, it's domed, although the difference is that it's all stained glass on the roof.
In fact, tell us about the cover of your book.
Yeah, it's a picture of the inside of the columbarium, and actually in the back is a picture of the outside of the columbarium. Mm-hmm. And you can see the niches. There's different sizes, and you buy a niche and pay, obviously, more for the larger ones. And there's three stories. And you can, it's just.
So you just walked in and took this photograph yourself that's on the
right,
cover. Because
correct.
It looks beautiful. I mean, it's well kept. It's gleamingly clean.
Well, it wasn't always that way.
So this is the cover. The interior of the actual columbarium is on the cover of your book. And then Jed is being shown the columbarium by this man that isn't really that. He doesn't live there. He doesn't really work there exactly. This man named Henshaw. And so Jed, I just imagine his jaw is dropping, and Mr. Henshaw says, quite an incredible place, huh? And then, Jed, why don't you pick up there after Henshaw says, quite an incredible place, huh?
Jed was speechless. He walked up to one of the walls and peered inside the niches. There were many ordinary metal urns of brass or copper, and there were some ceramic ones and wooden boxes. There were also glass and bronze urns, and some of the bigger ones had marble or quartz. It was quite an array. Some of the niches were stark, with just the urns and perhaps a picture inside. Others, however, were ornately decorated with items that were obviously meaningful to those who knew the dead person, as well as to the ones whose ashes were inside. There were war medals or ribbons and prizes won in sports and other competitions. There were membership cards for various organizations and pictures of people, places, and things. But this was San Francisco. The city was synonymous with art, music, design, style, gays, beatniks, hippies, and carnival-like merriment and lunacy. Many niches, therefore, were decorated to reflect that San Francisco spirit. He read a few of the plaques underneath the niches and was quite impressed. Henry Haight, Harvey Milk, Chet Helms. Yes, it's quite something, Jed finally said.
So this character, Jed, goes to the columbarium, not because he has some ashes to place there or that he wants his own ashes placed there. So why is he at the columbarium?
He's looking for a job, and they're looking for somebody to clean it up because it's not quite that gorgeous as the picture on the front cover shows when Jed first walks into it.
Mm-hmm. And the grounds. And so that's why we know that, okay, Jed is physically in good shape.
Yeah.
He can do physical work.
Yeah.
And that's what it's going to entail. And he doesn't seem to shirk for it. Apparently this position has been unfilled for quite a while.
There are a lot of people that are afraid of buildings that have housing death and don't want to spend a lot of time in it.
So it was run down in your story.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jed is pretty much free. The guy hiring him likes him, and he says, okay, Jed, go to work. And Jed said, but. So one of the things he wonders about is, well, if we're going to be doing some renovation, do I need permits? And this is on page 56 that Jed is asking Mr. Carl, says Jed will call me Carl. And so what does he say there?
He says, no, this is Mr. Henshaw answering Jed. No problem. I just need to know the parameters. Oh,
yeah,
oh, this is Jed
speaking.
Has
just said, I have a few questions before I get started. And
right.
He says, well, Jed, what's the problem?
Okay.
And Mr. Henshaw says,
no problem. Or Jed says, basically, I just need to know the parameters. You know, do I need permits before I do any work? Are there historical preservation rules that need to be followed? Who owns the building? Should I be talking to them? Mr. Henshaw chuckled. Nobody's touched that building in years. Why don't you just do whatever you think and we'll worry about the rest later?
And then he says, I don't know, Mr. Henshaw, it doesn't seem, but Mr. Henshaw interrupts, really, Jed, as long as you don't change the original structure, that's all that matters. Painting and repairing won't be a problem. If you say so. And then he says, and by the way, call me Carl, please. I have a feeling we're going to have a good, long relationship.
And sure enough, they do.
Because Jed basically is a likable character. He's had a rough life, but we like him as the reader.
As I said in the description before, he's one of those people that walks in a room and he's just special. Something about him and not
so
quite
the man,
sure what.
in charge of filling this position recognizes this, and he says, yeah, I think it's going to work out fine.
In fact, there's somewhere else, which I don't remember where it is, but he says he's so there's something about you, Jed, Mr. Henshaw.
Yeah.
Something and trustworthy.
When you were wanting to know about architecture and the terms, you sought some advice from people who know about architectural terms. Now, when you wanted legal, when you wanted Jed to say, hey, but do I need some permits? What do I need legally? Did you have to consult anybody legally when you were writing your book?
Yeah, well, I have a cousin who's a lawyer that helped. And I did consult him because, you know, when you're writing a book that's about a real building, and it was owned by the Neptune Society, and Emmett Watson is a real character, I want to make sure that everything was kosher.
Was in order. Kosher. You have some characters in your story that are Jewish, and they use a lot of Yiddish, which is delightful. And even those of us who don't know Yiddish recognize them, because you do use terms that are familiar in Yiddish. And then Jeff comments after this that he kind of liked in his life having structure, routine, and purpose, which a lot of homeless people don't.
That's right. And I think for him, he didn't for a long time. And it's kind of a little kernel of what's going to come for Jed, that maybe this is his time to get life together.
I sometimes wonder if people look forward to retirement and they retire and they no longer have that structure and routine and purpose that they had when they were working. And
they fall apart.
Yeah. And so even though we might push back against routine, it really is a rather soothing, if that's the word, way to know that when you start your day, you've got some kind of structure in mind. So Jed likes this, and he likes his job. And Mr. Henshaw wants to pay him, and he is going to bring him his paycheck. This is a couple pages after that.
Yeah.
And then Jed's, oh, gosh, if I'm going to get a paycheck, I don't even have a bank account. I haven't had a bank account in years. And so he's worrying about, gosh, if I get a bank account, then I'm in the system and I could be found out. He said, well, I can't run forever. And then this is where we learn what? Do you remember? Well, you wrote that because just a few pages before he said, gosh, the police are after me. But then we learn, well, I might as well open that bank account because he hadn't done anything wrong. He had nothing to hide. And he didn't want to have to prove that to the Los Angeles police.
Well, that's the issue. That you I mean you know they're not always guilty. Just because he's running from the law doesn't mean he's
anything. The police may be after him, but he's not guilty, he says, of what they think he has done. So it turns out though that Mr. Henshaw recognizes, oh, Jed, you know, when he brings him his first paycheck, you know, Jed, you probably don't have a bank account, so would you rather be paid in cash? And of course Jed says yes, he would rather be paid in cash. Now I mentioned these characters, that one speaks, well, he has his friends, and they speak with these Yiddish terms to each other. And then there's another character named Rose. And Rose is quite a character herself. I wondered, these two characters must be totally from your imagination.
Well, the characters are from my imagination. Back to when I was telling you I took pictures of the niches. There is a niche there. Let me go back and talk about Rose. Rose is a little old Chinese lady in her 80s. And she loves the San Francisco Giants. And there was a niche with a cookie jar, actually, that was the shape of a baseball and a pennant, San Francisco Giants pennant. And that was the picture of the niche that I used for Rose's character. So it has nothing to do with a little Chinese lady, but that's
but
what it
somebody
came from.
Had wanted those items in their niche.
Exactly.
And so you then filled in. Who could have been this person who loved baseball so? And it was a woman?
No, you don't, I have no idea. I just
you don't
took
even
the
know.
Picture. Yeah,
because you think of men as being baseball fans. But in your story, it's an 80-year-old Chinese woman that is just such a fan. And you also introduce a character who is rather mysterious because Jed sees this guy come into this Chinese restaurant and ask for a carryout carton. He doesn't want anything put in it. He just wants the carton. And the owner is not very willing to just sell him a carton at a reasonable price. He's going to charge him $10 for the carton. So they settle for $5. Okay, so this character, then Jed runs into him again. And why is this guy requesting these strange items? Well, when we get to know Tony, we learn what Tony is doing. And why was Tony going around asking for these odd items in your story?
He was to put the ashes of his friend in the columbarium, and then he ends up meeting Jed. He sees Jed in the hardware store, in the Jewish deli, in the Chinese restaurant, all to get items to put in his friend's niche.
For his friend.
Mm-hmm.
And his friend is somebody named Goldie. And when we're using the word niche, but Jed decides that, well, a niche is not very warm term. He prefers to call them apartments.
That's right.
And then you mentioned they're different sizes. Some of them are quite large. So Jed says, well, I'm going to call that a condo. Now, that was totally from your imagination, or is that?
No, that's actually from Emmett Watson.
Emmett does that.
Yes.
He calls a smaller one an apartment and a larger one a condo.
Yes.
So when people come in, he says, well, do you want an apartment or a condo?
Right.
I wondered about that. So you have these ethnic groups, like the Jewish people who get together and their friends, and you have this delightful Jewish man as one of your characters. What's his name?
Sam.
Yes.
I love Sam.
And Sam has a friend, too. And he gets together with his friends, and they try to teach Jed Pinochle. And
that's right. It's just interesting. You know, you ask where these things come from. I mean, that's what my father played when I was growing up, Pinochle.
Uh-huh.
I don't even know how to play the game. I had to Google it when I was writing the book.
Write your story.
But it was in my mind, old men played Pinochle.
Well, the characters are really engaging, and the story itself, based on this thing that most of us would rather not think about. We're going to take a break now, and when we come back, Pat Macias from the Museum of Northern California Art will join us to tell us about this new art and educational opportunity, and Emily will tell us why she became involved with MONCA. Welcome back to this hour-long edition of Nancy's Bookshelf. I've talked to Emily Gallo about her newest novel, and Emily was involved with the Museum of Northern California Art. So I've invited Pat Macias to come in and tell us about this new educational opportunity. Pat Macias was an art educator for 38 years. She has an MA in printmaking from Eastern Michigan University. Previously, she was director of the 1078 Gallery in Chico. She is now president of the board of the Museum of Northern California Art. She is here to tell us about what the museum is and how she got the idea. Pat, where did you get such an idea of having a museum?
Well, in 2009, Jane Dolan and Maureen Kirk knew this building was empty and had been empty for quite a while, and talked to Trudy Duesenberg and myself and said, why don't you come through it? Why don't you see what this would be like? And maybe you have some ideas. So we did, and obviously fell in love with it. And at the same time, I kind of had known Reed Applegate from my working at 1078, and that he had a collection, and he was looking for a place to have a museum. So I thought, well, let's see. Let's put these two things together. And it just kind of grew. And in 2011, we became a nonprofit. And in 2012, we actually signed a lease. The building is owned by the county. So we signed a lease with the county for 20 plus 10 years. And once they see it, it'll go on forever.
Now, when you say when they see the building, because people who don't live in Chico might not know what this building looks like. It's on the Esplanade, and it's one of the first things, if you come to Chico, one of the things you notice, because it's a very striking building, and people must wonder, what is that building? So describe the building itself. This is on the Esplanade in Chico.
It is. It's 1927, Classical Revival, and it was actually built for the veterans. but it has had many, many, many uses since then. And it has sat empty for, I would say, 10 years. And nobody really had a use for it at this point. Chester Cole was the architect and has also designed several other buildings in town, Laxon Theater, Trinity, Citrus School, Lobdell Cleaners. And you'll all see that they have kind of that same arch, repeated arch idea, which is what our logo is and how we kind of came about having that.
Well, it is such an interesting building that it's a shame that it was sitting empty and unused. And you saw the potential in this building. And you have, it's been so now 3 years that you've been functioning as a museum. But then you also, you say you're a pop-up.
We are a pop-up because museums are really changing and they're becoming much more interactive. Without a space, what we have done for the last 3-4 years is to have pop-up museums downtown, thanks to some very generous landlords who have given us a space for a month at a time. So we always consider ourselves as maybe always being somewhat of a pop-up because we want people to come in and find something new going on all the time rather than just pictures on a wall.
I'm talking to Pat Macias, and she is the president of the board of the Museum of Northern California Art in Chico. And you have a lot of participation. I was surprised at how many people are involved in these events that you carry on.
We have. We've engaged over 27,000 people in the amount of time that we have done events, that we have had pop-ups, that we have gone out into the community. And we've reached actually over 600 students just in the past year going into the schools with our outreach program.
So you mentioned schools. Now, how do you involve schools?
Well, one of our biggest points as a museum is going to be, is now and is going to always be educational outreach. We have a group of amazing docents. They're called driving docents, and they've been trained, and they take a piece of the artwork into a classroom and then do a lesson. And we've connected it to the Common Core this year because that is part of what teachers have to do now. So we want to make sure that we are also doing our lessons in connection with that.
In fact, I understand you were contacted by somebody who lives in Reading.
Yes, thanks to the article in Enjoy magazine. I opened the email the other day, and somebody wants us to come into a classroom in a middle school in Reading. So that would be fantastic. We are Northern California Art Museum, so it goes up to Oregon, over to Nevada, and down to San Jose.
So you're not limiting yourself just to the Chico area.
Oh, no.
Or to Butte County. So this, you are renovating the building itself. So when will it be ready for you to move in?
Well, we are going out to bid in January, and we hope construction starts in March, and we hope to be opened by the end of the summer.
Of 2016.
Yes.
So this is going to be your inaugural year. And you have an event coming up tomorrow. You call it Falling in Love with Monca 2. North State Structures from Towers to Tombs. That's a long title, Pat.
I know. It's we had Falling in Love with Monca last year, so we want to kind of carry this theme over from year to year. So the subtitle is about structures this year. And we're encouraging photographers who have taken photographs of anything that is a structure. I mean, we are talking from towers to tombs to chicken coops to, geodesic domes. Anything that somebody would classify as a structure would be part of this. And it is an exhibition and sale, so the artists can decide whether or not they would like to just donate the entire sale to Monca or 50% of it.
And you want these photographs framed and ready to walk out the door when somebody drops it off.
Yes.
And there is still time today. Starting noon today, they can drop off. Where do they bring these photographs that they've taken today?
The photographs can be taken to the Habitat Lab, which is at 199 East 13th Street in Chico,
and that's
from
until
noon to 4.
So until 4 o'clock this afternoon, yes, they can take a photograph, yes, by there. And then tomorrow, what time does the event start?
The event starts at noon, goes till 5 o'clock, and there will be refreshments, sweet refreshments and beverages, and a really fantastic exhibition of artists.
And we might remind people that this is not in the building on the Esplanade, not in the Veterans Memorial Hall. This will be also at the Habitat Lab.
Yes.
You might give that address again?
It's 199 East 13th Street off of Park.
Okay. So this seems kind of off the track of books, and this is why we're here to talk about books. And so I want to ask Emily, who's written this book, The Columbarium, how she got interested in this museum if you are a writer.
Well, I happen to be a friend of Pat. And at the very beginning, I was involved when it was just a little kernel in her eye of what to do, and have been involved ever since. I was a docent in the classroom. And the Columbarium is an incredible structure of its own. And so it really fits into the whole theme of the structures that Pat's doing.
And but originally you got involved because actually Pat's husband was a source of information when you were researching for your book.
That's true. A few years ago, sitting in Tin Roof, I was writing The Columbarium, and I didn't know what I was
Tin Roof Bakery, by the way, is kind of your writing studio.
That's actually is. And I was writing, and I was trying to describe the building, and I thought, oh, what do you call those things that are on the wall? I don't know what they are. And I think it was a Sunday, and I'm like, what can I do? And I started Googling a little bit, and I said, oh, I'll call Richard Macias. He'll know. And I did, and he was very, very helpful to me. So that was another way that Pat has helped me we've helped each other in the last few years.
That's right.
Along that.
So, yeah. Yes, Pat.
And I was just going to say, I think another connection and another way that the museum is going to be interactive and continuing to engage the community is that writers, book clubs can use the building. We'll be able to use the building once it's open. We want the community to be able to come in and, use a space, rent a space, and enjoy not only the museum itself, but a beautiful space to have a meeting.
So book clubs could meet there. You might have writing workshops.
I think that'd be a great idea. And in fact, people could take a little corner and sit down and write, just like I do at the Tin Roof. They might be inspired by the art and
Sure. So book lovers and book writers, mm-hmm, would want to come out and support this new venture in the community, this Museum of Northern California Art. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Pat, about the museum. And thank you for the work you have done on getting this off the ground. And we'll look forward to the event tomorrow afternoon at the Habitat Lab.
Thanks, Nancy.
And Emily, thank you for coming in and for your support of the museum and for this delightful book that you have written on this interesting architectural feature called the Columbarium.
Thank you.
The tourist shelter, which serves the homeless in Chico, is experiencing financial difficulty and needs our support. But how much do we know about the homeless in our community? You might be surprised to hear what they have to say when given a voice. My guests today are three of these writers, Alex Rizzo-Patron, Michael Long, and Veronica Jouar. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you all have...
Thank you.
Michael. And you've all brought something to read for us.
Yes.
And Alex, you have a poem called The Crimson Rose.
Yes, ma'am.
And Alex was actually born a gypsy in Spain. So if you hear an accent that's in his English, it's because he was born in Spain. He fought a bull when he was age 11. He ran away from home at age 14. He spent 3 months in the jungles of Peru. Now he's here in Chico. And tell us about your poem, Alex.
The Crimson Rose is one of the poems I've written. It's about something beautiful that yet doesn't have any feedback from the other flowers, whatever, except for a little boy. But the crimson rose represents beauty.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to read this poem,
yes,
for us?
Yes, I would love to. Shall I start?
Yes, please do. This is Alex Rizzo-Patron reading The Crimson Rose.
Okay. In the fields of the valley, behind the hills of the bold, in the lush grass and flowers, stood alone crimson rose. To the queen amongst them, the other flowers bow low. Through the unearthly silence stood the lone crimson rose, the only one of her kind, the most special in the group. Rising high above the rest stood the lone crimson rose. The sun shone above her, the moon her spotlight. The trees were her protection, the soil was her life. Yet for all of the gifts of which she did own, this beautiful flower sadly felt alone. The others in their envy, the way a flower goes, they blew away with winter. Now alone, the crimson rose. All the days pass, and the nights will come and go. They disappear for hours, now alone, the crimson rose. The months went by, flowers still did not show. She wished for even one, now alone, the crimson rose. The sun shone above her, the moon her spotlight. The trees were her protection, the soil was her life. Yet for all of these gifts, of which she did own, the beautiful flower sadly felt alone. One day in the valley, a small child roamed. His eyes felt upon her, the long crimson rose. His heart pounded softly. His desire began to grow as he gazed upon the long crimson rose. His eyes welled with tears. His voice filled the grove. A song he sang only for the long crimson rose. The sun shone above her, the moon her spotlight. The trees were her protection, the soil was her life. Yet for all of these gifts, of which you do own, tell me, beautiful flower, why do you feel alone? As he walked away on the road toward home, he raised a farewell hand to the long crimson rose. She finally had realized within her beauty grows, and she smiled somewhat sadly, sadly, the long crimson rose. In the fields of the valley, behind the hills of the bold, basking in the love of earth, stands the long crimson rose.
You've been listening to Alex Rizzo-Patron reading his poem, The Crimson Rose. And Alex is one of my three guests who are here from the writers group at the Jesus Center in Chico. And their publication is called The Derelict Voice. And I think the group chose that name itself, didn't it?
Yes.
Were you in on that, Alex, when the title was chosen?
We tried as many names as we could. And this was the end result, The Derelict Voice.
In fact, one of the poems in the collection is called Derelict. It's one of the poems that are in the collection. But you wrote your poem, The Crimson Rose, and you say you have a son?
Yes. And he's my inspiration in many ways. His name is Robert. Oh, his name is Robert, and he's been a real inspiration for me.
When you wrote this poem, The Crimson Rose.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Michael Long has a poem called Miserable Existence, and Michael was born in Bremerton, Washington. He was raised in Riverside, California. He started singing in the fifth grade. He left home at 18, went to college for a year in Phoenix, Arizona, picked up the guitar at 20, and he spent many years traveling up and down the West Coast. He is here in Chico now. Welcome, Michael Long.
Thank you.
Okay, why don't you read us your poem, Miserable Existence?
Okay, thank you. The clock ticks time upon the wall. Footsteps echo in the hall. The faucet drips water in perfect time, but I sit alone without a dime. The telephone has cobwebs on its receiver, waiting for a call for which once I was eager. Now loneliness and emptiness find me here without any cigarettes or even a beer. Oh, where can I find the joy that once was? Now I can't even cop a decent buzz. My car sits with an empty tank, no gas. I should probably get up off my lazy. Oh, when shall I rise and wash my face? I'm ashamed to be seen in most any place. Too late for the laughter, my friends now are tears, brooding and sulking over long wasted years. like a cancerous worm that gnaws me within. I cannot escape this cacophonous din. I think of the ways to just end it all, but I don't follow through. I haven't the gall. And so I sit, and life is a bore. Bitterness and misery torture me sore. I follow death's path without any resistance, eking out a lonely, miserable existence.
And this is Michael Long reading from his poem, Miserable Existence. Michael is one of the writers from the Writers Group at the Jesus Center here, and their publication is The Derelict Voice. And Michael, did you have anything you wanted to add about when you wrote this poem? Were you here in Chico when you wrote this?
Right? No, I was down in Riverside.
Ah, so you were writing poetry before you came to Chico.
Oh, much, much earlier than that. I started writing poetry summer before my senior year in high school.
And you kept these poems with you, so here was an opportunity to publish.
Many of my words have been lost or stolen as the years go by. I've spent 5 times being homeless, so I know what it's like to be on the streets with nothing and nobody. And a lot of things have gotten lost over that course of time.
And so you kept this poem and were able to have it published in The Derelict Voice. My other guest is here with a poem, Veronica Juar. And she actually worked at the Jesus Center in the resource department where the group meets. And she was watching this group and decided she wanted to join them. Veronica, you have a poem called Amongst the Lonely.
Yes, I do.
It's not exactly a poem, though. It's more prose, is it?
Right.
Would you
right.
like to read that? We'd like to hear your okay. poem, Amongst the Lonely.
Thank you. I find peace amongst the lonely, the poor, and the wicked. I'm comfortable with who I've become because I need not hide my deception or feelings of anger inside. I can act any way I want as long as I act like I believe it. I don't have to dress up or even wear shoes. I don't have to brush my teeth or comb my hair. If my feet are dirty, nobody will judge me. I have no home, yet there are those that are willing to keep me warm with their false sense of security. But some warmth is better than none. Some nights I walk around aimlessly, scared of what lurks beyond the next bush, wondering if the blisters on my feet will carry me another step to safety. Yet I push on. I wonder if this blanket with all the holes and chili stains will keep the wind from freezing me tonight. I wonder if I'll even sleep. I'm afraid to sleep. I'm afraid to try. I'm afraid of responsibility. I'm afraid to die. I wonder if I die, will I be forgotten, remembered, or pitied for the life I had chose to lead? Does anyone even see me anymore? Do they not see that I am hungry, cold, and lost? Is there anyone out there looking for me today? Or have I just been a mere speck on this ever-fleeting world of selfishness? Have you ever thought how it feels to go hungry, to know where you are going to sleep, what it would be like not to have transportation, a phone, or even a bus pass to get around, to have blisters on your feet and no chance to rest? When I look at my reflections, I wonder where I have gone. I don't see the person who once had dreams. I don't see the smiles that used to shine, nor do I see the smiles that are yours, and they too are free. Could it be that who I once was, I can never be again? Could it be that I will never have a friend? You know nothing about me, so please do not judge me by my circumstances, as I was not as lucky as you, or perhaps I am luckier. Perhaps I have escaped my nightmare, and you are still hiding in yours. The difference is that I see you, and I smile, because it's free, and it's all I have.
This is Veronica Juar reading from her poem, Amongst the Lonely. And did you write that poem when you were here in the writers' group, or did you write it before the writers' group?
I actually wrote it in the writers' group. I'm really inspired. I know how it feels to be amongst the lonely and to have people pass you by. And a smile is free, and it's really important. And working at the Jesus Center amongst the homeless really inspired me. You know, a smile is free, and if that's all you have, and it's worth giving to somebody.
And you have an email address, derelictvoice at yahoo.com. And this is an email address for those of you in the community who want to either make a submission, submit a poem you've written, prose, or if you would like to make a donation to support this work, because we hope this will be ongoing and will involve the community as a whole. Again, that email address is derelictvoice@yahoo.com. It's been such a pleasure meeting the three of you.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank my guests again, Alex Rizzo-Patron. Thank you, Alex.
Hey, welcome, and thanks for having us here.
It's a pleasure. And Michael Long.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. And Veronica Jouar.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
This Sunday is Valentine's Day and is the birthday of an author, anthropologist, and world traveler who for the first 6 years of her life was called Sweetheart. Valaine Smith traveled the globe by plane, train, boat, and automobile at a time when most women were limited to the home, hospital, or schoolhouse. Last year, she wrote her autobiography, Stereopticon, entry to a you know what? I was thinking, I didn't hit that word women enough, I think, and that's a key word in that sentence, so I'm going to start.
That's okay. You can start over on that
I'm
one.
I'm going to do that.
Whenever you're ready.
This Sunday is Valentine's Day and is the birthday of an author, anthropologist, and world traveler who for the first 6 years of her life was called Sweetheart. Valaine Smith traveled the globe by plane, train, boat, and automobile at a time when most women were limited to the home, hospital, or schoolhouse. Last year, she wrote her autobiography, Stereopticon, Entry to a Life of Travel and Tourism Research, and the Valaine Smith Museum of Anthropology on the Chico State campus held an exhibition that told the story of her pioneer life as a world traveler and tourism scholar. Valaine Smith, welcome.
Thank you.
You know, this exhibit was really in the museum that has your name on it, bears your name. And here was this exhibit that maybe, in case people missed it, tell us of what that exhibit included.
Well, among other things, some of the artifacts that I'd collected along the way, I was very proud of the fact that in Alaska I had been out on the muck beds at Cripple Creek where the mining takes place, and they removed the overburden of the dirt off the lower layers, and there I found a specimen of Pithecanthropus and also a very early horse, and as such, that was very interesting. But it's been the experiences of meeting the people and understanding how they live, understanding the cultures as they change because of change in terrain, history, and whatever other elements may play a part. I've enjoyed my life enormously from that viewpoint.
Well, this was a student-curated exhibit that they presented at the Valaine Smith Museum here on Chico State campus, but it has been taken down, so people can't go to the museum and see it now. What happened to the exhibit?
Most of the artifacts were returned to me. They're back in my home again. However, an interesting development from that comes from the Society for Applied Anthropology, one of the two very large organizations that represent practical anthropologists who do field work and have stories to relate and information that is important to the industry. They were aware of the exhibit, though no one had seen it, and offered to me at the university the opportunity to bring the exhibit to Vancouver, British Columbia, March 28th to April 2nd this year, and remount that and or any other portions of that exhibit that we could do in a room being provided for us by the Society for Applied Anthropology. That's quite an honor. I know of no other circumstances like this, certainly not in my career. Consequently, the university has also agreed that the two young ladies who were responsible for mounting that exhibit should also go and be there and be the guides for the students from other countries who will be attending the meetings. It's a very exciting prospect for all of us.
Well, I'm sure it is. For these young women, these students who are the curators of this exhibit are going to get a trip to British Columbia now to travel with this exhibit.
That's correct.
That is exciting. Well, this course you taught at the university, and when I was a student, I don't remember any courses in the anthropology department that had to do with tourism.
No, they were there because I introduced the first course here in 1980.
Well, you see, I was a student long before 1980.
True.
So, 1980, you introduced a course in travel tourism.
That's correct.
And you mentioned earlier practical anthropology.
Yes, it's the application of understanding what it is that the public wants to see and how do we provide to them the information about a foreign culture, one that is different from their own, and make it meaningful so that they better understand the people who are living in a foreign nation than they do when they sit at home and sit in front of the fireplace.
Well, I think that is the trend anyway, that I think years ago people wanted to just go to a country and be a tourist. And I think now they want to learn and want it to be a learning experience and an adventure.
This is true. However, again, I would observe that there is a perceptible change in tourism, so much so that the World Tourism Organization convened its first international congress last May. I was invited to attend in Italy, and in Naples for 4 days, individuals from mostly European countries, one or two from other nations, one from India, I was from the U.S., discussed what we can do to restore the broader interest in culture and the lifestyles of people in foreign environments, rather than what seems to be the current pattern of so many young people. Oh, we go off there and we'll drink and we'll party and, oh, we'll have a wonderful time. And that's all they do. And they come home not knowing, not learning anything about the residual values of the individual cultures that they're participating in.
Well, I might remind listeners that my guest is Valene Smith, and she is still traveling.
Oh, yes.
And she began the first class, as far as you know, 1980, taught the first class in tourism. And also, there are academic journals about this subject that didn't exist before.
That's true. There are now 100 academic journals written by scholars about the various aspects of tourism as they have perceived it and participated in it on a worldwide basis.
Well, recently, traveling is not what it was. You might avoid the Middle East or Egypt. You might know that to expect trouble there. But now you don't know where trouble might happen. Has that affected tourism?
I don't see it instantly, but I do anticipate that there will be a drop in the participation on a worldwide basis. We're not sure where ISIS will appear again, or believers in that, or just trends with it, or people just, well, it's a smart thing to do now. Consequently, yes, I do anticipate a decline.
Well, when I introduced you, I mentioned that the first 6 years of your life, you were just called Sweetheart, and that wasn't a pet name. That was your only name. You were born on Valentine's Day, and your parents, you said your dad, I think, called you Sweetheart, and then you go off to school, and everybody else has a name, and you say, you know, Dad,
I need a name. I need a first name. I will not be called Sweetheart.
Even though you were born on Valentine's Day, you thought it was time you get a name. So that's where the origin of your name, it's an unusual name.
Right.
Coming from the fact that you were born on Valentine's
Day. We took the tin out of Valentine. I'm what's left.
Took the tin out of Valentine. Well, and it is your 90th birthday, and you are still traveling.
Yes. We're still traveling.
You say, you travel with your husband.
I travel with my husband. We're going to British Columbia. We're going on up into Alaska in May. And we're going in the northeastern section of the United States and southern Canada in the fall. And I'm currently researching some more things in Alaska.
There might even be another book in your future, all we know.
There could be.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming by today. And I want to wish you a happy Valentine's Day and happy 90th birthday.
Thank you so much, Nancy.
I'd like to thank my other guests, novelist Emily Gallo, author of The Columbarium, Pat Macias from the Museum of Northern California Art, and the derelict voice writers Robert, Michael, and Veronica. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.